I just casually looked towards the canal, and I saw what I thought was a mannequin.
August 2nd, 1998, a brilliant young scientist is found dead near the campus of Georgetown University. The gruesome murder shocked D.C., but she wasn't the killer's only victim.
He jumped into the door with a blanket.
Unknown Subject, Season 3 of WTOP's American Nightmare podcast series, follows one man's gruesome 9-year crime spree and detectives' never-ending pursuit to find him. I'm Paul Wagner, host of WTOP's American Nightmare podcast series, available October 4th on all podcast platforms.
Previously on 22 Hours, an American Nightmare.
We believe Mr. Wendt is currently in the Brooklyn, New York area.
That idea of him suddenly being back in D.C. that fast, you know, was stunning, frankly. You know, and it just, you went from 0 to 60 because I really thought he wasn't in the area.
The Washington Post reports Wendt was traveling with two women in a white Chevrolet Cruze. The other vehicle was a box truck with two men inside. Police pinned the vehicles at Rhode Island Avenue and 10th Street Northeast. They arrested Wendt and took the others into custody.
Because when I leave here and I go back in the house, I'm going to kill each and every fucking last one of them. I'm going to shoot each and every last one of them in the fucking head.
It is being called a major crime scene as homicide investigators examine a house that caught fire in Northwest D.C.
The room is a crime scene.
They found four people, including a child, dead inside on the second floor.
Right now, it does not appear that this was just a random crime.
I said, but what happened? They said, we don't know. They killed the whole family.
Police have said they believe more than one person is responsible for the crime.
A wide-reaching manhunt for Darren Wendt, stretching all the way to New York City.
We had the DNA on a piece of crust. How did his DNA get into that house?
Got a package that I'm going to need you to bring down to me.
To do what he did to four people, including a 10-year-old boy, is just beyond words.
They were brutalized, and we saw the evidence of that.
The jury has just reached a verdict in the murder trial of Darren Wendt.
He was going to strike the American dream just by committing murder and mayhem.
This is 22 Hours, an American Nightmare. When jury selection began for Darren Wendt's trial in September 2018, it was still summertime in D.C., and it felt like it. Courtroom 203 was my refuge from the sweltering heat. As the trial stretched on, outside the courtroom, the seasons were changing. Fall was moving in, the days turning cool and crisp. And by the time the trial was winding down, it was just a few days before Halloween. Over the course of the 6-week trial, we heard testimony from some 70 witnesses, each designed to get a particular part of the story or piece of evidence in front of the jurors. But those millions of little details were often disjointed and out of order. On October 22nd, Judy Pipe and Laura Bach entered the courtroom ready to write the final chapter in the U.S. versus Darren Wendt. Over the next day and a half, they would deliver their closing arguments. Something you should know about closing arguments, they're different than the rest of the trial. During closing arguments, lawyers on both sides of the case are finally able to explain what all that evidence means. They finally get to say who they think is responsible and how they think the crime happened. They finally can turn from the witness stand to the jury box and speak directly to the 12 people who will decide the defendant's fate. Their goal? Wrap everything up with a nice big bow. Closing arguments are also different because, unlike the trial, the attorneys can present their interpretation of the evidence. They can frame the story how they want. During a trial like this, you learn how important stories are in the justice system. Telling the jury the story of the crime is essential before a trial's conclusion, and the court expects it during closing arguments. A closing argument weaves all the evidence together, it's compelling, and it pulls at every emotional string of the case. And most importantly, it has to click with the jury. We wanted you to be able to hear Judy Pipe and Laura Bach in their own words and with their own voices, but we don't have the audio from the closings. We've petitioned D.C. Superior Court to release their recordings from the trial, and it's considering doing just that for the first time ever. But our request is still under review. Both women spent several hours making their appeals to the jury. So we've asked our colleagues, Lauren Larson and Julia Ziegler, to help us out again. They'll be playing the roles of Laura Bach and Judy Pipe, respectively. We'll begin with the defense. Judy Pipe opened by quoting the prosecution.
"We agree. This case is what nightmares are made of. What happened to the Savopoulos family and to Vera Figueroa was an unfathomable tragedy. But Darren Wint is not the monster who brought about this nightmare. Darren Wint didn't kill anyone. He didn't take anyone hostage. Darren Wint sits here an innocent man. The government's case consists of strategically selected pieces of the puzzle, purposely designed to mislead you into believing that Darren committed these crimes. Every time there was a piece of evidence that didn't make sense in the government's own case, they dismissed it. That's why there were so many gaps. The questions you have about how the crime unfolded, those questions exist because the government's theory is wrong."
Then Judy Pipe picked up an idea that would become a theme in her closing, a civic-minded call to duty. She said part of their role as jurors is to check the government's power.
"The burden of proof is on the government. The burden of proof means the government has to prove Darren did this. It's your role to check the government's power, not rubber stamp it. The government has done a lot of finger pointing, sometimes screaming and finger pointing at Darren Wint. But the burden of proof means you point your finger at the government and you say, you prove it."
After reminding the jury that the burden of proof was on the prosecution, Judy Pipe directed her narrative to the specifics of the crime, zeroing in on those gaps in the government's case she mentioned earlier. She insinuated that each of those gaps should be enough to create reasonable doubt in the jury's mind and acquit Darren Wint. First, she questions how three adults and a child could be restrained and controlled for nearly a day by just one person. She boldly stated they couldn't, and that there was more than one assailant. And the fact that there was more than one person involved in the kidnapping was reason to doubt Darren did it. Then she went even further. She told the jury that the government had purposely presented an incomplete timeline of the home invasion to mislead them. She even called the prosecution's evidence suspicious. For example, Margaret Pressler's testimony. Remember Amy Savopoulos' friend Margaret, who says she saw Amy walking in the neighborhood the day the family was taken hostage? Prosecutors theorized during the trial that while Amy was out on a quick Starbucks run, Darren Wint got inside the house and took Vera and Philip hostage. They said when Amy returned, she was taken hostage too, likely minutes after Margaret Pressler saw her walking up that hill toward her home. Judy Pipe called that whole premise ridiculous. She said it wasn't Amy who Margaret Pressler saw. It must have been someone else. Margaret said Amy was in business attire and wearing a knee-length skirt, a blouse, and a jacket. But that's not what Amy was seen wearing that morning on surveillance video at the doctor's office with Philip. She was in a blue tank top and white pants. And that is the same outfit she was wearing at the time of her death.
Margaret Pressler's testimony doesn't make sense. Okay, say the break-in happened while Amy was out of the house, walking to Starbucks in business attire, and then she's attacked by her assailant right as she walked in the door. And then she changes back into the clothes she had been wearing earlier? It wasn't Amy Savopoulos that Margaret Pressler saw, because the abduction happened much earlier in the day.
Judy Pipe said the government wants you to think that Amy was out walking, because that means the assailant could have taken the victims hostage, basically one by one.
They're lying to you. They presented you this evidence to try to mislead you into thinking it could have been one man that did this. You can't trust the government's evidence. They've really cherry-picked it to match their theory. They have attempted to mislead you.
She said the prosecution left out anything that didn't fit their theory, including evidence which pointed to other suspects, like the person seen driving the Porsche shortly after firefighters rushed to Woodland Drive. The man who saw that driver, Andrew Zeron, testified the man behind the wheel of the Porsche had short hair. Judy Pipe said the prosecution didn't call Andrew Zeron to the stand because his testimony didn't fit their theory. And that's not all. Judy Pipe said there was more evidence that prosecutors ignored, like Darren's van being parked near 24th and K Streets.
It would be a mystery if Darren Wint parked the van there. He didn't have a reason to be there. But Stefan Wint did. The dorm painting job was right around the corner. The van was parked there because Stefan Wint is the one who parked the van there.
Next, she turned to the forensic evidence, starting with the hair found stuck to the bloody bedding in the upstairs bedroom.
Now, the DNA can't tell us whose hair that is, but it's 2 centimeters long. That's a tiny hair. That's not Darren Wint's hair. Darren Wint had long dreads. If it was his hair, it would be longer. That's a reason to doubt Darren Wint had anything to do with this.
It wasn't the only argument Judy Pipe had for Stefan's involvement. She pointed to the man seen running on surveillance video behind LaFontaine Blue, where the Porsche was found burning. Yes, Darren's sister Samantha lived nearby, and he knew the area. But everyone in the courtroom seemed to agree that wasn't Darren Wint. So who was it? Judy Pipe reminded the jury that on the other side of Annapolis Road was Stefan's apartment. And she pointed out to the jury the man in the video isn't seen running towards Samantha's apartment. He's running in the direction of Stefan's. Then Judy turned her attention to Darren's other brother, Darrell. The night Darren was arrested, all the cash police found was in Darrell's possession. Not only that, she said, Darrell and his friends testified that he was running the show when it came to getting all the money orders.
He didn't leave as many breadcrumbs, but he did leave one big, major breadcrumb. The money. It doesn't make sense why Darrell would have all the cash. The reason he had the cash is because he stole it. Nothing else makes sense. That is a reason to doubt that Darren Wint had anything to do with this.
Judy Pipe also brought up Darrell's criminal history that we've told you before consisted of an assault and several low-level drug offenses. She was trying to paint Darrell as a hardened criminal. And that's relevant, she said, because the crime was so sophisticated. For example, the intruder wore gloves and didn't leave a single fingerprint behind. He may have worn a mask or a hat, we don't know, but he made sure not to leave any DNA behind either. There was no evidence of a break-in. The ransom drop was organized without raising alarm, and the hard drive containing the family's security camera footage was stolen from the house.
He's not new to this. The people who are capable of pulling off a crime like this are smart enough not to leave half-eaten pizza. The people who did this wouldn't have been that careless.
What about the brothers' alibis? The government showed the jury Stefan's work records that he was working on May 13th and 14th of 2015.
Those timesheets were handwritten. Stefan wrote them and signed them. No one checked them. The PCM records are worthless.
And Darrell's alibi? When he was questioned by police, Darrell said his memory about those days was fuzzy. But cell phone pings and phone records showed his phone in Montgomery County, Maryland on May 13th and 14th, far away from Woodland Drive. But, Judy Pipe argued, just because his phone was in Montgomery County those days didn't mean Darrell was with his phone.
Ladies and gentlemen, he's faking a lack of memory because he was at that house on Woodland Drive. And Darrell had a lot of phones. He told you that. He was selling drugs in May 2015. He knows what a burner phone is.
Then Judy Pipe reminded the jury about investigators' initial suspicions around Jordan Wallace, Sava's assistant who dropped the ransom money off at the house.
Who knows what role, if any, Jordan Wallace played? Did he just post something inadvertently on social media about his rich boss and the wrong person saw it? Who knows? Jordan did have inside knowledge of the house and the security system, and there was something very suspicious about what he told police when he was first questioned. How he changed his story. At first, the Mosler was locked and he had to go into the house to get the key, and then later he said it wasn't locked. Jordan starts working for the family just 7 weeks before this happens and then lies to detectives? Maybe if there'd been further investigation of Darrell and Stefan, we wouldn't have these questions about Jordan Wallace.
The man running in the video, the short-haired man driving the car, where the van was parked, whether it was Amy walking. They were all unanswered questions that she said gave the jury enough reason to doubt. Not surprisingly, Judy Pipe also spent time in her closing argument on the evidence that implicated her client. Most of the DNA evidence against Darren was where he'd testified they'd find it. On the pizza, because he did in fact eat the pizza. On the construction vest in the burned out Porsche, because he'd put it on and then later thrown it at his brother. And in the hard hat, because he had put the hard hat on his head in the garage at the Savopoulos mansion. But There were two pieces of forensic evidence that didn't fit with Darren's story. One was the hair in the bloody upstairs bedroom. The defense had always maintained that was Stefan's hair. And the small traces of Darren's DNA found on the kitchen knife propping open the basement window. Prosecutors said while Darren propped open the window with the knife to listen for the money drop, they acknowledged he wouldn't be able to see Jordan going into the garage from that window, but he could have heard him pull up, walk into the garage, and open the Mosler door. Judy Pipe wasn't letting that theory go unquestioned. She said if someone were watching and waiting for the money drop, why would they go all the way down to the basement and have an obscured view when they could just stay on the second floor, keep an eye on the victims, and see the money drop clearly? Toward the back of the Savopoulos house, there was a set of windows right over the garage.
If Darren Wint propped the one window with the knife, then how could you explain why all the other windows in the basement were propped open? It just makes sense that it was law enforcement. It got hot down there while they were working in the basement, and they propped some windows for airflow.
So how did she account for Darren's DNA on the knife? Cross-contamination. Judy Pipe referenced the multiple times during the forensics collection and analysis process when the DNA of analysts turned up on items found at the house. Even Emily Head, the ATF's lead DNA expert on the case, accidentally transferred her DNA to a set of towels.
She's trained not to contaminate a crime scene, and she did. Not intentionally, but she did. And what's more, she testified that it tends to happen. I can't stand up here and say how his DNA ended up on that knife. But it's a microscopic amount. Less than one half of a nanogram. If he touched it, there'd be a whole lot more DNA than a half a nanogram.
She reminded jurors that just the slight brush of Emily Head's lab coat left more of her DNA on the towels than was found of Darren's on the knife. Judy Pipe also reminded the jury of Darren's testimony. She reminded them he didn't have to take the stand. He could have chosen to remain silent.
There's so much Darren Wint said to you that makes sense. And it's not just what he said, but how he said it. He was calm and respectful with every single one of his answers. You saw true, genuine emotion.
Another reason for jurors to doubt Darren Wint's guilt? She said, look at his actions immediately after the murders.
He acted like an innocent man. He goes back to his father's house and stays there for several days. And on that Saturday, he goes to see an immigration attorney so he can stay in this country, so he can start a life with Vanessa. He went and got his fingerprints taken by the FBI for a background check. When he saw his face on the news, he panicked. But he decided to come back and turn himself in. He put his faith in the justice system. That's the way an innocent man acts. They come back and they hope that the justice system does what it's supposed to.
As far as the prosecution's claim that Darren had been sitting in court, listening to witnesses and building his own timeline of events to exonerate himself, Judy Pipe provided a simple explanation. She said, when you're telling the truth, it matches the evidence. That's reality. As she was winding down her closing argument, Judy Pipe went back to where she started, summarizing for the jury how the unanswered questions, the gaps, add up to reasonable doubt.
Your verdict must be unanimous, but your reason to doubt does not have to be. As long as each one of you has one single reason to doubt, you must find Darren Wint not guilty. You get the final word. Once your verdict is delivered, there's no taking that back. The only possible conclusion in this case is that Darren Wint is not guilty of each and every one of these crimes.
And with that, Judy Pipe ended the defense's closing argument.
Hi guys, Megan here. In addition to 22 Hours, I'm also working on a new podcast for WTOP called The DMV Download. We are taking a deep dive into the biggest, most interesting local stories of the day that are happening around DC. So if you enjoy hearing me here, it's a little bit of a different vibe, but I hope you'll check out The DMV Download. Thanks.
Now we'll turn to the prosecution's closing argument. If the jury acquitted Darren Wint, then the man prosecutors said was responsible for some of the most heinous crimes in the city would walk free. The government had spent years investigating this case. Going into closing arguments, you couldn't help but sense Laura Bach felt the pressure. She began with a question. Why? It seemed like she knew it was the question no one in the jury, or anyone else, could wrap their heads around. Again, our colleague Lauren Larson is reading as Laura Bach.
Four completely innocent people who'd done nothing wrong were savagely beaten and stabbed, asphyxiated and burned. And for what? Because of that man's greed for $40,000. Darren Wendt wanted things he couldn't have. And in May of 2015, Darren Wendt was backed into a corner. He'd been kicked out of every home available to him. His father had given him 30 days notice to get out of the house. And when Darren Wendt was backed into that corner, he decided he was going to take from the Savopoulos family.
Laura Bach recapped the timeline. Those phone calls, messages, and cell phone pings that show how May 13th, 2015, started as a perfectly normal day for the Savopoulos family. Sava went out to Chantilly, Virginia, to get the dojo ready for the grand opening. Amy took Philip to his doctor's appointment, and Vera arrived at the house for work. Laura Bach took the defense's claims about the gaps in that timeline head on.
All the evidence shows that sometime that afternoon, Amy left the house and her friend Margaret Pressler saw her out walking in the neighborhood. They said, "We're misleading you, lying to you about Margaret Pressler seeing Amy because she got the description of her shirt wrong." Is there really such a huge difference between khaki pants that go below the knee and a skirt? Is that what we're arguing about here? Why would we mislead you about that?
She argued, in the end, it really didn't matter whether Amy Savopoulos was at home or not when Darren got inside the house. Even if Amy, Vera, and Philip were all home at the same time, she said Darren could have overpowered all three. And she said the timing of Amy's call to Sava refutes the defense's theory anyway. Amy didn't call Sava trying to get him to come home until 4:30 that afternoon. If she were attacked and taken hostage in the morning, alongside Philip and Vera, Laura Bach asked, what were they doing for those 5 hours?
Were they all just hanging out with their kidnapper? Doesn't it make more sense that the kidnapping happened closer to 3:30?
She continued with the timeline when Sava returned home and Darren forced him and Amy to make call after call to arrange the money drop, to cancel the appointments, and to try to discourage people like Vera's husband and Nelly Gutierrez from coming to the house.
When you ask yourself how in the world were these people able to make all those calls and sound so normal, imagine what you're capable of when somebody has your little boy tied up. Sava even calls Jordan Wallace. You've heard those voice messages.
Then she played part of the voicemail from Sava to Jordan again for the jury.
Hey, Jordan, it's Sava. Time to change your voicemail. It still says you're at Autobahn. Slight change of plans tomorrow. Instead of going out to Chantilly and helping me put that that thing together, would you please go straight to the Hyattsville office and wait? I've got a package that I'm going to need you to bring down to me, and probably won't be ready to leave the office until like 10 o'clock or so. But if you could just go in there and check on things like those eBay listings, etc., I'm sure we got plenty to do.
You can hear how he's holding it together. And he called Jordan Wallace because he knows he's a kid that'll do what he's told to do.
Laura Bach opposed the defense's claim that the home invasion was the work of sophisticated plotters. She said it was Sava who made it go off without a hitch.
Darren Wendt has his wife. He has his son. Sava's doing everything he can to make sure his family stays alive. Sava Savopoulos figured out how to get the money to the house without raising suspicion. That guy didn't figure it out.
She was pointing at Darren Wendt. Laura Bach did acknowledge the holes in their case, but said they didn't add up to reasonable doubt.
The government has the burden to prove each of the elements of the crime to you, but we don't have to prove to you each and every detail. Darren Wendt did not leave anybody in that house alive for us to know all the details.
The mysteries in this case, like the questions that surround the pizza, Laura Bach cautioned jurors not to fall down a rabbit hole trying to answer things like why Darren ordered the pizza.
You'll be back there for the next 3 years trying to figure that out. Maybe it was done to reassure the family. Maybe he was just hungry. We don't know. You're not going to know. What is important is the DNA on that pizza. The pizza that you get out of that room, the crust has the DNA of Darren Wendt on it.
Another mystery she said they really couldn't explain, the location of Darren's minivan. Prosecutors were clear that 11:47 on the morning of May 14th, about 2 hours before the house went up in flames, Darren Wendt plugged 24 and K into his phone. And about 15 minutes after that, he was seen slipping into the Savopoulos' garage. But why did he choose to park the van near where Stefan worked? And why have it towed back to Maryland later? Laura Bach leveled with the jury again about the whole van thing.
That may be one of the questions you don't have an answer for. If you want to figure out the van thing, then go figure it out. There's no evidence Stefan Wendt had anything to do with it.
And while many of the aspects of the case would remain unexplained, she did provide possible answers to some questions which have been left lingering throughout the trial. For example, how did the garage door just open for Darren when he was seen approaching it by the men at the Australian ambassador's residence across the street? Laura Bach said he opened it himself using a garage door opener he'd taken with him. It's just the workers couldn't see it in his hand. Crime scene investigators found the automatic garage door opener just inside the house. Another question she tried to answer, who was the man seen running from the burning Porsche through that grassy area behind the church parking lot where she said sketchy stuff happens? If it wasn't Darren, who else could it be?
Do you think it'd be that hard for Darren Wendt to pay somebody back there to get a bucket of gas and set a Porsche on fire?
She said the defense's case wasn't based on evidence, rather speculation and guesswork.
These are flights of fancy. The DNA says it's Darren Wendt. The eyewitness testimony says it's Darren Wendt. The digital evidence says it's Darren Wendt. The only evidence is against Darren Wendt. He is the one who committed these crimes.
She pointed to the digital evidence against Darren. The fact that his Facebook account went dark during the 22 hours the victims were held captive and then killed. And then all those incriminating searches on his phone in the hours and days after the murders. How to beat a lie detector. Countries with no U.S. extradition treaties. Hideout cities for fugitives. And she reminded the jury that Darren was the one seen with the wads of cash after the murders. The cash he was seen flashing around the gym with Godfrey. The shopping trips in New York with Vanessa. Darren had lied to them both about winning the lottery. She said prosecutors pulled lottery results from Maryland, D.C., and New York, and there is no record of Darren winning any money.
Stefan Wendt was never seen flashing around $100 bills, and Durrell was only seen with the money after Darren Wendt came back from New York. All of the forensic evidence links Darren Wendt to the crime, not Durrell and Stefan. The only person anybody sees at the house on May 13th and 14th is him, Darren Wendt. Douglas Ventura, the tow truck driver, takes one person to that minivan in downtown D.C., Darren Wendt. The Porsche was burned near where Darren Wendt used to live, and his minivan was burned near where he used to work. Darren Wendt is the one who knew the victims. Darrell and Stefan didn't work for Sava Savopoulos. Darren Wendt worked for Sava. Do you really think Darrell Wendt and Stefan Wendt just happened to pick a family and it was the Savopoulos family? We're supposed to believe that his brothers just picked them at random and it happened to be the man who ran the company Darren Wendt was fired from?
The defense argued from the start of the trial that it wasn't Darren, but his brothers who were the murderers. Laura Bach had to address the accusations in her closing.
When the defense stood up here in their opening statement, they blamed Darrell Wendt, Stefan Wendt, and Jordan Wallace. Make no mistake that they've tried to blame three completely innocent men. It's not believable that Stefan would have been involved in this. There's not an ounce of evidence showing that. Nobody accuses Stefan Wendt of anything until defense counsel stands up here in opening statements in this trial. Come on. We all understand why Stefan's name is in this, because they share the same mother. Darren Wendt's got an excuse for his DNA on the construction vest, and he came up with one for the pizza crust. But how do you explain your hair on the bed next to that bat that was used to kill the victims? He's got to explain that hair on the bed, and he can't blame it on Darrell. So he blames Stefan. Now, poor Stefan Wendt, who's doing nothing but trying to get his family members' jobs in May of 2015, is thrown right under the bus. When Darren Wynn testified, did anybody hear Stefan's name even mentioned? Not even the defendant had the nerve to come in here and point the finger at Stefan Wynn. Yes, Darrell Wynn helped Darren. He helped him get money orders, and he helped him get a hotel room. Darrell should have known better, but he helped him because it's his brother. There's no evidence Darrell was involved in the murders. There's no digital evidence linking Darrell to the crime. Darrell's DNA is not in that house.
Then, like Judy Pipe, Laura Bach drew attention to the contamination of evidence. She said, yes, some of the crime scene investigators had inadvertently left some of their DNA behind, and they didn't know how, maybe by coughing or sweating. And they're professionals.
Darrell, boy, he's a mastermind in their eyes. He must be some kind of ninja burglar to not leave any DNA in the house. Darrell's in the house for that whole time, and he didn't even cough once. He probably didn't even breathe the whole time.
During her closing argument, Laura Bach scoffed at Judy Pipe's suggestion there hadn't been enough investigation of Darrell. She said prosecutors at the U.S. Attorney's Office interviewed Darrell multiple times about his whereabouts on May 13th and 14th of 2015.
We're not morons, people. Darrell was with his brother on the night he was arrested for murder. Yeah, we're going to look. Do you think we're going to go, la, 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 we're not looking at this? Do you think we just take his word for it? Do you really think we're stupid? No, we corroborate it.
Darrell testified he was at his friend Anthony's house on the 13th, the day the family and Vera were taken hostage, watching a video his friends had just published to YouTube. And the date it was uploaded on YouTube matched up. The next day, when the Savopoulos house was set on fire, Darrell said he was at a friend's house watching the kids and had pizza delivered. Prosecutors backed that up with a Domino's receipt.
This is called corroboration, folks. He gives you an account of his whereabouts and law enforcement goes to corroborate. Darren Wynn's the person who committed these crimes. He wants it to be someone else. The problem is, there's only one person who's implicated by the evidence. This isn't about Darrell Wynn and Stefan Wynn, no matter how much he wants it to be.
Then she turned her focus to Darren's testimony.
He absolutely has a constitutional right to hear the evidence against him, but there's nothing in the Constitution that says that man can fabricate testimony. There's nothing in the Constitution that says you can falsely implicate innocent people.
She referenced Darren's history of lying under pressure, like when he lied to police and said he was Stefan during the traffic stop. She reminded the jury of Darren's admission. She said his first instinct when he gets into trouble is to lie. And that wasn't her only shot at Darren's credibility. Even before the closing arguments, she'd presented evidence to discredit Darren's story about Ed's house. Darren testified he was at Ed's the night of May 13th, that he fell asleep on Ed's couch, and the next morning, Darrell showed up in the Porsche and took him to Woodland Drive. During her cross-examination, Laura Bach made a point to ask Darren if he'd heard any loud, strange noises while he was sleeping, like gunshots. Darren said no. At the time, we had no idea what she was getting at. It was one of those loose ends just hanging out there. Well, it turns out, on the morning of May 14th, police got a report of gunfire near Ed's house. A DC police officer went out to the neighborhood to knock on doors and canvass for any witnesses. He didn't find the source of the gunshots. He didn't even confirm there had actually been any gunshots. But one of the doors he knocked on was 16 Atlantic Street, Ed's house. When he testified, the officer said he didn't really have any recollection of the incident, or non-incident, really. It was 3 years earlier, and it was such a routine occurrence. But his written report said no one answered the door when he knocked, using his metal baton. Prosecutors asked him, how loud would you have knocked? Usually loud enough to wake up a whole apartment building. Darren Wynn said he never heard any loud, strange noises at Ed's house. Laura Bach concluded his story wasn't credible.
If there's anybody in this jury that believes what Darren Wynn said on the stand, you can just go right ahead and acquit him.
As Laura Bach neared the end of her closing argument, she addressed the question that she'd basically avoided throughout the entire trial. Whether Darren had help committing the crime. She told the jurors, as far as they were concerned, it didn't matter.
It's completely clear how one person can do this. But you don't actually need to figure out whether Darren Wynn acted alone. If you have a doubt that someone else was involved, if you think that, even if just for a little while, somebody helped him, as long as he's actively participating in these crimes, he's guilty. If there was anybody else involved in these crimes, we at the U.S. Attorney's Office will spend the rest of our lives trying to bring them to justice. We're asking you to find him guilty because he did this. Not because it was such a horrible crime and someone should pay for it, but because he did this.
Along with the counts of burglary, arson, kidnapping, extortion, and murder, prosecutors asked the jury to find whether the killings were especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel, which would call for enhanced penalties during the sentencing phase. Laura Bach detailed each victim's injuries. As she spoke, photos of the victim's wounds were again projected on the big screens in the courtroom. Family members and friends who had packed courtroom 203 for the closing arguments were clearly caught off guard, blindsided by the disturbing images of their loved ones. Some were in the courtroom for the first time. They covered their faces. Others stifled sobs.
Even though they gave him everything he wanted, all $40,000, there was nothing they could do to save their little boy. It's finally time for you all to hold the defendant accountable. It's time for you to hold Darren Wynn, not anyone else, accountable for what he did. It's time for you to hold Darren Wynn accountable for turning 3201 Woodland Drive into a graveyard.
And with that, Laura Bach finished her closing argument. After the closing arguments, 12 jurors, 6 men and 6 women, got up from the jury box and filed into the deliberation room. Boxes and boxes of evidence and exhibits were carted back to them. They had weeks of testimony to consider. And we were left to wait. We didn't know when a verdict would come, so basically we were hanging around D.C. Superior Court. As we waited for word, Jack and I poked our heads into other courtrooms, catching parts of other trials. It makes you think, as horrific as Vera and the Savopoulos family's ordeal was, tragedy was not confined to courtroom 203. Every day trials were starting up. Murderers are seeing the evidence against them. Families are grieving and looking for answers. It brings to mind what Amy's friend Margaret Pressler told us about how she felt about the killings. It makes you think about how bad people can be. It was Thursday afternoon, just 2.5 days into deliberations, when Jack and I got notice. The jury weighing Darren Wynn's fate had reached a verdict. We raced back to courtroom 203.
The jury has just reached a verdict in the murder trial of Darren Wynn, charged with killing 3 members of a D.C. family and their housekeeper. We are expected to learn of the decision within the hour. Darren Wynn is charged with 20 counts.
The benches in the courtroom were filling up quickly. The lawyers had been notified. The victims' families were summoned. Amy's mother and father, Jim and Rona Martin, didn't have far to travel. Over those 2.5 days, we saw them waiting in a little vestibule outside the courtroom.
WTOP's Megan Clardy is at the courthouse. She'll bring us more details shortly.
We were shoulder to shoulder on the gallery benches as the judge took her seat. The frenetic buzz in the courtroom hushed to silence as the jurors filed in. It was a strange feeling. Exciting, but also nerve-wracking at the same time. The jury foreman stood up and delivered the verdict.
Breaking news on WTOP.
Guilty on all 20 counts. That is the verdict in the murder trial of Darren Wynn, charged with killing 3 members of a D.C. family and their housekeeper in what has become known as the D.C. Mansion Murders.
It took several minutes for the foreman to go through all 20 counts against Darren Wynn. When he read the guilty verdict on the first count of first-degree burglary, Darren dropped his head. Then came the 4 counts of kidnapping. Guilty. Extortion. Guilty. First-degree felony murder. Guilty. First-degree premeditated murder. Guilty. On each of the murder charges, the jurors agreed that the killings met the threshold for enhanced penalties. They were especially heinous, cruel, and atrocious. Darren Wynn, wearing a purple dress shirt and gray slacks, was led out of the courtroom. The next time we'd see him at the sentencing, he'd be wearing an orange jail jumpsuit.
Weeping erupts in the courtroom after Darren Wint is found guilty on all 20 counts in the D.C. mansion murders of a family and their housekeeper more than 3 years ago. Let's go live to the courthouse in WTOP's Megan Cloherty.
Hillary, it was obviously a very somber, tense mood as the word guilty echoed over and over and over again throughout the courtroom. And immediately you just saw the relief fall out of the shoulders, the tension rather, fall out of the shoulders of the Savopoulos family. Sava Savopoulos' father just began weeping, as you mentioned, and couldn't really hold it together after this much time.
Often, prosecutors give news conferences after big verdicts. That was not the case this time. As Laura Bach and Chris Bruckman came out the front doors of the courthouse, they didn't stop to take questions. But when one reporter asked how they felt about the verdict, Laura Bach responded, she was relieved. After 6 weeks of testimony and then days of waiting for the verdict, after becoming immersed in these complicated narratives of the trial with their twists and turns, it was surreal to think it was over. Minutes after the jury delivered its verdict, Jack and I split up, both tackling different parts of our coverage. I posted up for multiple live shots on WTOP from outside the courthouse, while Jack raced around trying to catch jurors for an interview. After weeks of seeing them in the jury box, we knew most of their faces. But as Jack and the other reporters approached them, most jurors just kept walking.
And I remember getting caught because I was like, wait, I'm the last one out and nobody's. You know, all the reporters were all off to one side, and there you were by yourself. And you caught
chasing
me.
Chasing after you.
I was like, what? You recognize me?
That's Stacey Preval, one of 12 jurors who decided on a verdict.
But I was like, I can't talk about this right now because we were, you know, I would say like through the trial, at least for me, I had a job to do. And it was in a lot of ways intellectual, right? This was the, you know, had to bring my analytical game. We had a duty to fulfill, you know, and I believe we did that. So then, but it was the aftermath, and that was also quite shocking to me. I didn't realize how emotionally brutalized I would feel after.
We didn't talk to Stacey that day. As she said, she wasn't ready to talk to anyone leaving the courtroom on October 25th. But a few weeks later, after she had some time to process her experience, Stacey agreed to meet with us at WTOP for an interview. In all, we spoke with 3 of the 12 jurors. We wanted to know what the jurors discussed in deliberations, how they came to their decision, and whether they had any remaining questions like we did. We also wanted to know how the trial impacted their lives. During the testimony, we learned how the case affected the Savopoulos family, their friends, even the Wints. But the jurors had also experienced this tragedy in their own way.
So one of the things that I kind of held on to through the entire trial was the first witness, who was Amy's father.
Amy Savopoulos' father, Jim Martin, was the first witness the prosecution called on the first day of trial. And he was one of the only family members to testify.
I so appreciated his testimony, just talking about the family, talking about the household, you know, in such a loving way. He really painted a picture of a house full of love and activity and, you know, even sort of, you know, giving little humorous, you know, he found little humorous tidbits to share about the family. And, I remember thinking, like, he referenced, like, Hot Wheels and Hoops, you know, with his grandson. And so I found that testimony very touching because it just took us out of the realm of the gruesomeness of the crime and made us get to know this family. It made a difference to me just in the why we were there, you know, why we were there and why this is important. It did make a difference to me.
Stacey also shared with us how deeply being a juror affected both her personal and professional life. As a self-employed business consultant, she said it was challenging to spend all day in the courtroom and then go home and try to catch up on work. Stacy said it also caused her to lose sleep, and she said she felt isolated during the trial, since jurors are not permitted to talk about the case with anyone. That isolation was harder to take, for example, after the 2 days the jury spent listening to the medical examiner's testimony detailing the victim's injuries.
Those 2 days were very difficult, and I thought they'd be difficult, but I ended up still being surprised by how difficult they were. And quite honestly, and I am a, you know, investigative discovery, law and order junkie, you know, but they always show like the little page with the outline of a person and saying, well, this was where someone was hurt. I was not prepared for real photos. There's no other way than to say it was difficult, and they were brutalized, and we saw the evidence of that. There's just no other way. And I think it was different for each of the victims. I think, you know, you feel differently for each of them because they all seem to suffer a little differently.
Another juror, Jeremy Holden, told us he had a lot of trepidation going into the courtroom. But from day one, the communications professional and college instructor said he found himself fascinated by the trial and the role he had to play in it.
Something clicked and I just had to pay attention, and you had to stay focused. You had to determine how extensive the notes you were going to take were that weren't going to interrupt with your ability to focus on attention. So, you know, I guess there's some type of resilience that once things get started, your emotion just kind of shifts and we adapt. And now we're in this moment and this is where we are. This is going to be life for the next 6 to 8 weeks.
He said he tried to maintain a sense of normalcy in his life during the trial. Jurors in the United States versus Darren Wint weren't sequestered. At the end of each day in court, they'd return home.
There was one moment where I stopped at a bar for happy hour, and they had the local news on, but it was on mute. So it was just, you know,
like the pictures.
Look down. Yeah, talk to the person next to you, or, you know, don't, yeah, that's right. But with the closed caption on. So it was just kind of glanced up, and you saw the bottom third, you know, Mansion Murders. Like, well, can't look up for at least 3 minutes, right? When they move on to weather, I can check what the temperature is going to be tomorrow.
But you got to live your life. I mean, as much as you possibly can. I mean, what a tough 8 hours you have to go through every single day for 6 weeks. So to go home and then think about it in a dark room would probably not be best either.
No, what's nice, though, is that life still has to be lived, right? So dinner has to be made. The dog has to be walked. All of these things continue. And at the outset, I thought that was going to be the challenge. Like, how do I go home, turn this off? Maybe I'll have an interesting dream tonight. But beyond that, you know, life kind of takes over at this point. So for me, it became relatively easy to compartmentalize. But yeah, certainly how was your day today was a difficult question to answer.
Both Stacy and Jeremy remarked on the detail and meticulousness of the government's case, but it was Darren Wint's testimony that really made an impact.
Well, were you surprised when they said, you know, like, oh, and we called to the stand Darren Wint?
Yes, I was very surprised. You know, that it was an interesting day because, you know, defense started their case and all of a sudden all these people were in the courtroom. And then it was announced Darren Wint was called up. And I was just like, wow. I guess my thought was, he had to. He was the only person that could provide an alternate theory of the evidence that was a lot of the hard evidence, if you will, may have been circumstantial, but, you know, he had to testify about why his DNA was in certain places and why people saw him in certain places. And so he attempted to do that.
Did you find it believable?
I'll call it parts of it were believable. I believed him when he said he was in the house. I believed him when he said he was outside of La Fontainebleau. You know, those things were corroborated and believable. Some of the other things I did not find credible.
Brian, another juror we spoke with who only wanted to be identified by his first name, said that hearing Darren's version of events actually strengthened the government's case in his mind.
So the burden is on the government to prove their case. And from his perspective, he's hoping to create doubt. But I think the fact that his argument was not very plausible almost did the reverse. Like, it made a lot of us more certain that the government's story made more sense, because then we're like kind of weighing two versions of the truth, so to speak. And you know, we're supposed to be the deciders of fact. And essentially, he, by providing an alternative, then almost, you know, it's on a balance, and he almost tilted the balance the opposite way. And I know attorneys typically tell their clients that they shouldn't testify on their behalf, and I think it was a bad decision for him also.
In his assigned juror seat, Brian was one chair away from the witness stand. He said Darren was hard to read, and parts of his story seemed to go against reason.
He seemed very like he'd had a long time in jail to think about what he was going to say on the stand. It didn't seem spontaneous or, like, I don't know about rehearsed, but it seemed a little just too much of a narrative, I guess. I don't know. Some of the decisions didn't ring true as what a person would do. Like, stay at a house for 24 hours just because somebody took your van away. Like, and yet when he's at the mansion, he is walking out the door to catch a bus. Like, why didn't you catch the bus a day ago so you could go home? This story just didn't make, in toto, didn't make a lot of sense.
Still, the jurors said the group was careful not to dismiss Darren's story. They thought it was important that they give it a fair hearing. Jeremy says that was in part because when Darren was testifying, he didn't seem like a one-dimensional monster on the stand.
From my vantage point, I was close to the witness box, close to the bench. And so I just felt like his emotions throughout humanized him. And, you know, it added a challenge in terms of sitting in judgment now of a human who did terrible things, but a human nonetheless. And that added a level of, I guess, of just weight is the only word I can think of for that. You know, your head is kind of going back and forth between the lawyers and the witnesses and the judge. Right. But certainly there were times where I saw the full range of emotions, like tears, laughter, mm-hmm. You know, just head down, you know, at different times. So very, like, name a human emotion, and we kind of saw it.
What was your impression of his testimony as to his story of why he was there? Did any part of what he said ring true, that he was at his friend's house drinking? Or
it was plausible to me, I think, at the time. I think the story could make sense to me. Mm-hmm. I think my brother showed up in a Porsche, and I thought, let's go. Where are we going? Let's hang drywall. That starts to get a little bit fishy, but okay, I mean, let's hear it out. So, yeah, I think that there were elements of the story that warranted consideration. And needed to be taken seriously, if for no other reason than this is a really heavy and important decision that I have to be a part of.
But how they came to that decision was different for each juror. They take us inside the deliberation room. Now to the deliberations. Again, we're talking to jurors Stacey Preval, Jeremy Holden, and Brian, who preferred we didn't use his last name. Stacey said on the first afternoon, they were mostly just letting off steam. They hadn't been able to talk about the case for the past several weeks, even with each other.
Then we started to think about, okay, how are we going to approach this? And there were differing suggestions, but we ended up, at the end of that first day, thinking about completely recreating the timeline, based on all the evidence presented, including Darren's testimony. And so we were starting there, which was very daunting. And all I could think to myself was, how in the world has, you know, the prosecution not given us one exhibit with the entire timeline?
By the next day, Brian said they'd changed their minds.
After we came back in on Wednesday, day two, we basically all had decided that that was going to take forever and might not really lead us to anything. So we kind of went with more trying to resolve doubt that we had.
We sort of came up with the other idea, which was really to go through the charges.
Using a large whiteboard to jot down notes,
they broke down all 20 counts Darren faced, charge by charge: burglary, arson, kidnapping, extortion, theft, felony murder, and first-degree premeditated murder.
That was going to be our roadmap. And coming from that, there were things, timeline things that we grappled with. You know, we had stickies on a wall and recreated things. Oh, well, this person said this. Did the phone line, you know, did the phone record support that? Or where was this? And, oh, Darrell's phone was here? So we went through things like that, but we didn't do, we did not recreate a massive timeline as we originally thought that we were going to.
Brian said they referred to their notes and to the evidence presented to first determine whether there was proof each crime had been committed. Once they decided that all 20 crimes had occurred, then Jeremy said they turned to who committed each crime. Where was Darren on May 13th and 14th? And where were Darrell and Stefan?
And then, you know, the hardest question is the final one, right? It's like, you know, yeah, you have to go through and say, did a kidnapping happen? Like, we bravely determined that one did. Like, do we believe that the evidence supports the conclusion that Darren Wint committed those? Like, oh, well, pause.
That's the harder question.
That's the harder question, right? So we, of course, like most humans, saved the hardest question for last. But, and then, you know, it was just like going back to some of those questions. Are you sure that all of those questions that you had, are you comfortable that you have an answer to them right now? And I think by going through that process, I got the sense, I became comfortable. Some people got there faster, but the question was never one of how can I convince you that I'm right and you're wrong? It was, let's pause and let's figure out what are the lingering questions that are still out there, because maybe I got there too fast. Maybe I'm missing something and it's me that's wrong. So let's just kind of talk out these questions that are still outstanding for people.
Jeremy said the prosecution's rebuttal undercut Darren's credibility, just as Laura Bach hoped. Both he and Stacy cited the testimony of the officer who used a baton to knock on Ed's front door when Darren said he was there sleeping on the couch. Another part of the government's rebuttal case the jury found persuasive: the evidence to support Darrell's alibi.
Again, sort of this is where the government went back and proved their case, where, you know, the phone records and Domino's receipts and, you know, all of that stuff that kind of showed that that the defendant's theory of the case was not plausible.
What did you think of Darrell Wint's testimony?
You know, as I felt with a number of folks, it was clear he didn't want to be there. You know, I think he was trying to be careful because he had clearly been on both sides of the law. I felt he was genuine when he talked about, you know, in a couple places where he was concerned about the safety of his brother, right? And that he wanted to make sure he was turned in a way where he was not killed. And I believe that. I felt like he was genuine when he said, like, and there are times when you don't want to know and you don't ask any questions and you just put the blinders on. And then coming to a place where, you know, the blinders had to come off a little bit and that it required action. And then he had a cousin come in and help him. So I think he's probably a more complicated dude than you immediately see.
Brian said he didn't find Darrell as trustworthy as other witnesses.
He was part of the puzzle that, you know, corroborated the government's version of the story. But if he had been the only piece of it, it might not have been as strong of a case. His alibi, like the location of his phone, never entering the district on those dates, his story about going to Gaithersburg to his buddy's house to look at a video. It fit.
We asked Jeremy how effective he thought the defense's tactic was in blaming Darren's brothers.
There wasn't, to me, a very compelling story about Stefan Wint being in that house. So then you come back to that hair that we heard about quite a bit. I don't know how much, you know, relative to 6 weeks, but it's a pretty important piece of evidence. Mm-hmm. And so that, to me, beyond everything has to break your way, at some point Occam's razor comes into play. You know, like, what's the simplest explanation for how these pieces of evidence got to where they are.
The jurors we spoke with said the deliberation process was collaborative and friendly. They took their civic duty seriously. We found it interesting that some of the nagging questions we have about the case were the ones they had to confront to find resolution.
That knife in the basement window, the prosecution kind of tried to imply like it was important in some way. But there was very small amount of his DNA on it. Okay. It was in the basement where it didn't seem like he had been. There was apparently other windows propped up with other things like a Frisbee and a screwdriver. The knife was not a murder weapon, probably. It didn't seem like any of the wounds matched it. There's no blood on it. So why do we care about it?
The van was another riddle.
They spent a lot of time on the van and how it got from point A to point B and then back. And they interviewed the tow truck driver. And but the bottom line is it doesn't make a lot of sense. And nobody saw the van at the house. So why it would be parked at that spot, I don't really know. But in the deliberations, we kind of got to the point where we realized that the core of the crime, he wasn't charged with anything related to the van. So it didn't matter if we figured out what exactly happened and how it got there and how he got back to the house. Clearly, he got back to the house.
Brian said he and the other jurors realized that even though those pieces of the crime had consumed hours of testimony, they really weren't all that important.
When it comes down to it, the scene of the crime is the house. The theft, the burning of the van, the burning of the car is all secondary. It leads you to the crime happening and the attempted destruction of evidence, presumably. But the details of how that happened or whether he was the one who set the car on fire or not, because the guy in the video clearly wasn't him, doesn't matter, really. The core of it is what happened in the house, and he admitted he was in the house, and his hair was up on the bed upstairs, and his DNA is on the pizza, which was upstairs.
Jeremy said he and the other jurors made peace with the fact they wouldn't get all the answers they wanted.
There were some questions that, at the end of the day, didn't matter from an evidentiary perspective. They matter in a sense in terms of we're humans. We want to know what happened. We don't have an eyewitness of what happened behind those doors beyond Darren Wynn, right? I mean, as humans, we want to fill in the gaps of those stories. But can you reach a determination as to this one individual's culpability and set those questions aside?
Probably the biggest question jurors struggled with, did Darren act alone?
I'm sure everyone feels like, could there possibly have been other assailants? And so, you know, I think we struggle with there could be possibilities of other assailants that we had no evidence of, right? But in some ways, we're all not supposed to check our common sense at the door. You know, this was a difficult crime for one person to pull off alone.
Brian agreed.
There was a few of us, maybe two or three, who had some hang-ups about certain of the charges. And I'm trying to remember exactly which ones. But it came down to the abetting clauses. Like, they weren't convinced that he was the trigger puller, so to speak. So what does that mean?
The only other assailants that were put forward with the alternate theory of the crime, we could pretty much do, you know, time records and phone records and domino receipts. You can pull those other assailants out and you were left with one guy. And he was the guy that put himself at the house.
In the end, jurors didn't come to an agreement about whether anyone else was involved, but they didn't have to. Under the jury instructions the judge provided, jurors could still vote to convict Darren, even if they thought he had help.
Clarification from the judge that, you know, abetting the crime is exactly the same as committing the crime. If you are a willing participant in or directing it to happen, you know, so to speak, you're just as culpable.
I think we felt as a jury that we were trying to make sure everyone was heard and that no one was feeling herded into some sort of decision. And so, but we also had, you know, those jurors that were making sure that we weren't sort of like falling down black holes and not keeping track, right? So we're marching towards some sort of destination, but let's keep focus. So we had that too, right? So we had all of that in that jury room, which was powerful, helpful, and I believe the way things are supposed to work.
We respected each other's opinions, and we were patient with people who had doubts that needed to be discussed, and we were open to being persuaded, and I think we went about it the right way.
After going through the charges point by point and considering the jury instructions on aiding and abetting, jurors took a vote and came to a unanimous decision. Guilty on all 20 counts. Jeremy said going to deliver the verdict, he felt nervous. But sitting in the courtroom, hearing the foreman read it out loud, he felt relief, assured the jury had made the right decision. Stacy remembers being surprised by how emotional she felt afterward.
You know, and so certainly rendering the verdict was very emotional, I think, because of the finality of it all. But I think it was also, for me, the putting down of the analytical side and then moving into what I can only describe as mourning. You know, I mourned. I continue to mourn for Vera and Sava and Amy and Philip. I mourn for them, these people who I never met, but who have deeply touched me.
There was another question the jury didn't have to answer. It's one that has consumed us from the beginning, and one we've gotten questions from listeners about as well. Why?
I think that's another one of those questions that we may never know, right? Like, was it entirely about money? Was there a revenge component? We don't know, and I think I have to be comfortable that I'm not going to know that, and that's okay. From a larger picture, you know, I thought as I've prepared to be asked about this from friends and from people who are finally, you know, wanted to talk about it, you know, I just thought about how I don't want this to fundamentally shift my perspective of the world that I live in. A very terrible, monstrous thing happened to a family, and that's awful. And not to diminish that, but I don't want my takeaway to be that there's monsters hiding around every corner.
I think we ask those questions why when we see human beings being monstrous to other human beings. But I believe the simplicity of it all was, you know, the money and not wanting to get caught. I you know, again, I don't know, three different kind of murder weapons, right? We had something sharp, we had a baseball bat, we have asphyxiation, like, you know, that again, you're like, wow, one person using all three, you know, seems, you know, kind of odd, and we won't have answers because we don't have a confession and we don't have video.
Do you ever want to hear from Darren Wynn to tell the truth, or have you kind of moved on? Like, do you want to hear him admit guilt or admit what really happened?
Well, I think I would certainly, for the family, for the Savopoulos, for Virilicia Figueroa's family, but also for Darren's own family, for his brothers, if he were to confess and share that, I think it would be a good thing. But I'm not holding my breath.
On the next episode of 22 Hours, An American Nightmare.
We can't bring them back, and I think that's what would make them whole. So hopefully this gives them a small measure of closure.
Prosecutors asked the judge for the harshest possible punishment for Darren Wendt. And ahead of his sentencing, we learned more about Darren's criminal record.
When Darren stabbed me in the neck, if it would have been a little bit lower, the doctors told me that I would have died before I made it to the first hospital.
22 Hours, An American Nightmare was written, edited, and produced by Jack Moore, and me, Megan Cloherty. Julia Ziegler is our content advisor. Thanks to her and Lauren Larson for presenting the closing arguments in this episode. If you like 22 Hours, rate us on Apple Podcasts. It helps other listeners find this podcast. We're putting together another episode answering your questions about the crime, the case, and how we put this podcast together. Send us your comments and questions on our live blog at 22hourspodcast.com or on Twitter at 22hourspod. Music for this episode is Haters Hate by Ramon Messam, Cast of Pods by Doug Maxwell, and A Great Darkness Approaches, Can You Feel It? By Elephant, available in the YouTube audio library. Rhythmic Pulse by Daniel Birch and Weirder by Drake Stafford, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0 International. 22 Hours, An American Nightmare is a production of WTOP in Washington, D.C.